For taking the time, man. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on. Good to see you.
Yeah, you too. I guess for everyone listening, this is Oliver Weingarten, a guest German heritage, who is the founder and CEO of Summit Sports. But I think before we get into that, what we love to do, Ollie, is just dive into the guest origin story, right? Comic book style, and understand a bit about where you come from. So we'd love to understand your origin story, Ollie, and what your childhood looked like, I guess.
No worries. I'm not sure what comic book style means, but I'll try and be as succinct as possible. Okay. Actually, Polish heritage. My grandfather was born in Poland, but my dad was born in Brazil. So I'm actually half Scottish, half Brazilian. And I could have ended up in the Copacabana. I ended up in the south side of Glasgow.
Yeah, you got the bad side of the draw there.
Yeah, certainly did, and I certainly play football like a Scot and not like Cafu, sadly. So I studied law and German in Scotland, actually, and then went down to Manchester, did an MA in sports law and converted to English law, and then got a training contract at a really reputable law firm in London. And the newly qualification, I went and worked at the Premier League as sort of general counsel and commercial and IP. And for me, that was a dream job. I knew I didn't want to stay in a law firm. I didn't enjoy it's not even just the politics, it's the timekeeping and the way it worked and the infrastructure, the hierarchy. I just didn't really enjoy that lack of autonomy, which I always craved. I suppose I had an entrepreneurial spirit from quite a young age. And I thought I was always going to be a football agent and commentator like Jock Brown, who you might have heard of. He was a very famous Scottish commentator that was also a lawyer and an agent. But I saw an advert in the Lost Society Gazette for the Premier League job, and I got it. And it was a dream job. It's one of those jobs that you just bounced into work. And I had a huge amount of autonomy in my role because the guy who hired me left after 3 months. He was director of legal and business affairs. He went off to the FA with Brian Barwick to bid for the World Cup. Which was a fascinating project for him, but left me to really sink or swim. And I was reporting directly to Richard Scudamore on quite a lot of my issues. And it really forged the way for the Premier League on how it needed to protect its IP, because obviously it was founded off the back of broadcast. That's where the majority of its revenue came and still comes from. And it was, well, how do we protect this? So I did a lot of anti-piracy, trying to tackle pubs with foreign decoder cards, ended up in the European Court of Justice, online streaming. But I was doing title sponsorship deals with Barclays, Wrigley's, chewing gum deals, you know, lots of sponsorship deals, working with the clubs across a variety of projects. It was really, really interesting. But after 7 years, I got approached for a role that actually I wasn't sold on at the beginning. It was the...
Sorry, Ollie. Sorry, I hate interrupting guests, but I want to stick in the Premier League for a little bit because you talk passionately about your football. I saw the Rangers shirt on the on the wall earlier. Tell me about some of your experiences there. You must have some crazy stories about some of the meetings or encounters you had.
Well, I mean, probably won't go into too many of the encounters, but some of the anecdotal stories. Like, I went to do the chewing gum deal for Wrigley's to become a partner. And the now chief exec, Richard Masters, was director of sales and marketing, essentially the commercial director. So we went down to, I think it was Plymouth. And as we got there, his wife went into labor. So he had to turn around and he had to leave me to close the deal. And that was, you know, I'm talking about him. I had a lot of those sorts of moments. We had this court case against a pub landlord called Mrs. Murphy. It became very famous. She was a pawn. She was being used by the suppliers, but Mrs. Murphy was the figurehead. And I remember coming back from the High Court and we had a decision that went our way. And there was this little last minute issue that the other side raised on competition law. And the judge at the time had dismissed it. And I came back and we did a note to the clubs and we said, look, we've won on this, but there was a little issue that the other side have raised on competition law. But Lord Justice Pumphrey's been very dismissive of it, but he's going to do a hearing on it. And then sadly, that Christmas, Pumphrey died. And the High Court judge died. And they brought in a new judge and it opened up a can of worms and it created an endless amount of issues. So it just shows you don't celebrate what you think is a victory too prematurely. I did a recommendation to the board to sue Google and YouTube. So we ended up with a class action in the US. lots and lots of really interesting projects that I was involved in. And you know, the characters at the clubs are quite interesting, but they're all deeply passionate about their club, community, and making money. And that's what the Premier League is there to do.
Interesting, love it. And then, why would you leave a gig like that? You sound like you're in your stride, doing really well, you know, interacting with people, being challenged, learning, growing.
I hit a glass ceiling. I wasn't really able to go anywhere else, and it was becoming a bit like Groundhog Day. You know, every 3 years you do another cycle of broadcast and sponsorship deals, and then you're protecting them, and it's like a bit like bashing frogs, and they keep popping up. And I say this interesting job came along, which, you know, to a Formula One purist, you would have jumped into bed immediately and said, yes, I'm going to do this. It was Secretary General of the Formula One Teams Association. But once you got under the bonnet and you realised how political the role was, you know, first of all, you've got to try and take on Bernie Eccleston. Secondly, it's on behalf of all the teams. And the irony of trying to get all the Formula One teams to work together probably isn't lost on you, the amount of self-interest and egos that are around one table when you've got them all in the room is pretty impressive. But I went to see Martin Whitmarsh, who was the team principal of McLaren, as chief exec team principal of McLaren, but he was also the chairman of FOTA, the Formula One Team Association. And I looked at my phone after the meeting, and I had, I think, 13 missed calls from my missus. I realized I'd been sat in his office for 2 hours where he just talked to me. I think he'd asked me two challenging questions, one of which was, well, why are you leaving the Premier League? What's chief exec going to say about you if we ask for a reference? Which wasn't really challenging, but at least he asked me a question. But he just talked at me for 1 hour, 50 odd minutes, and he sold it to me. And I was just like, this will be a really interesting role. The only thing is, my missus is pregnant. I've got to live in Geneva, but I'm going to be traveling to 20 races across the world.
With a newborn.
Well, no, leaving her at home with a newborn at some point. But I decided to do it. And funny enough, to this day, I still don't know who referred me to the headhunter that approached me for the role. And it was 3 years of character building experience, walking around the paddock as a dartboard, literally a walking dartboard. People just throwing darts. I mean, Christian Horner, who's obviously very prominent in the news at the moment, once said to me, he goes, I feel sorry for the job you've got to do. And I said, well, you effing make it difficult for me. And that was the challenge I had. They were all full of self-interest and really only coalesced when they really had to. But even when I thought there was alignment on an issue, they'd then go into a meeting with Bernie and they'd be flip-flopped. So it was very, very challenging. Went in there to do a commercial and financial analysis of the sport. And within 3 months, Bernie picked off Ferrari and Red Bull with a huge bag of gold each. And the rest all fell like dominoes because someone would say they're under duress, but ultimately you couldn't underestimate just how much leverage Bernie actually had over the teams. So wow. I ended up having to dissolve the association after 3 years.
Wow. Okay. Yes. You, I guess, those two experiences, right? The Premier League and F1 is some of the most, I guess, like commercially focused organizations of sports in the world. It's almost like you were bred in the dragon's den almost.
Well, I went out of one frying pan into an even hotter one. And yeah. You know, the experience I got over those 10 years has stood me in good stead. But I then went into startups after that. You know, I had my own little, you know, advisory agency where I was working with brands and athletes. And then I worked in Formula E in its first season, which was a real startup. And you tried to corral the teams to work together with the promoter. It was a little bit easier than Formula One. And then I worked with a sports tech company using CGI and data to create a VR proposition. And I did 3 years with Virtually Live. And that was you go from Premier League, you go from a blue chip sports property to a startup, which is run by a Swiss board with very interesting views on how business should be run. And then you've got all the US, the Valley stuff, and, you know, there's a studio in Seattle, a studio in Malaga. I'm working remotely across the world, going to races, trying to build up a sport and broadcasting side of the business, working with developers on not just the product development of what we were trying to create as the world's first ghost racing game where you could race in real time against drivers, but actually create a very immersive experience in VR as well. So it's new technology. You're having to work with data tracking companies. You're having to work with brands and IP issues. So it was fascinating. And actually, that's what opened me up to esports, which is how I got to become the founder CEO of London United, because we did a esports activation with Red Bull in VR. So in a reg VR, and Sebastian Buemi challenged others to compete against him. And then I went to Wembley Arena one afternoon to watch the CSGO finals. And I thought, this is incredible. This is what esports is about. Short form, snackable, bite-sized content, production's incredible. Young families all here buying merch, cosplay. The whole thing just was like, this is the future. And I met someone and we set up London United, which was a purpose-driven esports organization, which was there to use essentially gaming and esports as a mechanism for addressing social issues. And we partnered with the Mayor of London and lots of talent. We had content creators, we had players in teams. We addressed nutrition, knife crime, mental health, physical health. It wasn't about sitting on your ass for 23 hours a day playing video games. It was actually about, you know, there are skills that you require to work in this sector that are transferable. Video editing, video production, public speaking. It's not just about how good you are with a control. So that was, I mean, I'll take a pause, but that was true startup life for a good few years.
I can imagine, yeah. I mean, one of my best friends, a guy called Michael O'Brien's got a production company now called Millhouse, but he worked for Quadrant. Yeah, you know those guys. Yeah, he worked there for, I think, about 3 years. Yeah, he opened my mind to it, because when you think about gaming, like you said, you think about how good they are at the game, but you forget that these players spend like sometimes 18, 20 hours a day streaming and playing. There's only so much time you can keep that up for, right? Take like Ninja, for example, right? He was going to be the best in the world for a certain period of time, but that's not sustainable. There's always a younger 12-year-old coming up through the ranks who's playing it literally nonstop. So I like how you sort of, understood the broader impact that someone could have other than just being really good at Call of Duty or really good at Fortnite or whatsoever.
Yeah, I think ultimately we started as a grassroots path to pro organization, but our success was the bane of our life, funnily enough, because we were so successful in finding talent. We ended up competing at a professional level, and then that cost us money. We got into the Champions League equivalent of Valorant, the VCT, and all of a sudden you've got players on thousands of pounds a month with boot camps and trainers and coaches and, you know, everything that comes with it. They're being treated like a professional athlete. So we were very keen to give grassroots gamers an opportunity to play in a more competitive environment and understand what it was like to be part of a team. But we also had the other end, which was essentially a marketing exercise. We thought being competitive would get our name out there and brands would want to engage with us more. But funnily enough, the feedback we got from brands were that were more interested in the initiatives we were doing in Camden in the Centre of Excellence, the education initiative, United Education, the campaign with the Mayor of London on education, than actually just being as part of the VCT programme. And that was quite enlightening. And that actually was a good endorsement for the approach that London United always took as being purpose-driven.
Okay, and is that still running now? Did you close it down? What's the status with it now?
It went into distress because I had a fraudulent investment deal, and then got acquired by a company called Ludus Gaming, who didn't really honour what they were meant to do. So I would just say, watch this space.
Okay, fair enough. I can hear the conviction in your voice. Don't mess with the lawyers with the lawyer.
I am very sad. I had a lot of loyal people who supported me. We created a community. We built a brand. We never quite unlocked recurring revenue, which was a challenge, which is still an ongoing challenge in esports, as you'll see with a lot of models. And you know, we were on the cusp of creating something. You know, I was in Forbes. I was interviewed in Forbes organically, funnily enough, on the aspiration of what London United was to be, and also the scalability of going to Berlin and Dubai and other cities to replicate the model. But we just needed a little bit more funding to get us there. And Sadly, it didn't work out like that, and I wanted to do right by my players, by my staff, by anyone we owed money to. So I sent the business into distress. I thought I had the right partners to come in and continue the growth, but nothing was ever done. And as I say, it's sort of died a slow death.
Fair enough. And look, I've never worked in that world, but like I said, I've got a good friend who worked for Veloce, right? It was Quadrant was part of Veloce, and I understand from his experiences, like even they just seem to sort of have this constant stream of funding. We're very good at networking, meeting investment groups, requiring funding, but a lot of their projects seem to be absolute money pits. So how do you see the future of of commerce in esports with it being so heavily reliant, it seems, on VCs and private investment?
I mean, I think if I was to go into the sector now, I wouldn't put the word esports anywhere near the title of my business. I think it would just be gaming, if anything, because esports is just a natural extension. But I always described us as a media company. I said, like, take a square and put the creators in there and all the events that we're doing, the activation and the merchandise and the Twitch streams, etc. Look at us as a media business. And I think you've seen a big shift in how these organizations are portrayed. Misfits is a great example. They, I think, call themselves an entertainment organization. And you're right, too many. I mean, FaZe Clan have just been acquired by GameSquare. Probably it was a fire sale in the end because the share price went so low. They've really made a mess of the business model.
Interesting. It's weird because I know from Mickey's side, when he was thinking about starting Millhouse, it's like if he sort of communicated to the world that they're a media company first, people are like, well, what? They don't understand like what you actually do, you know? They don't understand that. So I think people try and look for these like niches to try and communicate to everyone what they do, as opposed to just sticking to what they know, being a media and entertainment business.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I think esports has had a lot of bad press, but I mean, I think even gaming in the last God knows how many months, there's been a huge amount of redundancies that have come across, with the publishers, etc. A lot, someone described it to me the other day as COVID hires, but I actually think it's a little bit, I was going to use the word endemic because that's probably more associated with the brands. Endemic brands, but I think it just epitomizes what the industry is really about. It grew very, very fast during COVID, and for the publishers, they got the game development done, and that's it done. They can get rid of a lot of people, but an esports hasn't generated the revenue that people anticipated. So it's really been, there've been a lot of cullings.
Yeah, similar to the industry I work in, right? I'm a partner in a recruitment company focused on the SaaS industry. And yeah, I guess 2020, 2021, part of 2022 saw this huge sort of upsurge in VC funding, right? Low interest rates, a lot of money getting flown about. But at some point, you have to drive efficient growth. You have to be profitable. And it seems like esports suffered the same fate as the SaaS industry did, which was overhiring and not enough ROI per hire. And a lot of money getting thrown about with not much, I guess, intent or plan behind how they're actually going to make money long term.
I think you're right. Yeah.
And on that, you're on this entrepreneurial journey, right? You go through something like London United, which seems extremely close to your heart. You feel like you're doing good for the world, create a brand you're extremely proud of. Things don't go to plan. How do you, as an entrepreneur, then, when you're at an apparent low, right? Pick yourself up and focus on a new venture. What did that like transition look like between understanding, okay, London United's not going to continue, and then coming up with Summit Sports and getting some of the partners on board that you have?
Well, I had a hiatus. I mean, I think I should say I worked at Boxer before Summit Sports, which is how Summit Sports came around, but I'll mention that in a second. But I think there's no point in sugarcoating. There were a lot of lows at London United. People ask, what were the successes? You don't really remember the successes, or they don't last that long. There were loads of successes. I mean, you'll need to Google London United to see how successful we were in building up a really credible brand. But it's the lows that really get you. And ultimately, it all comes down to money, doesn't it? I mean, without money, you can't really do anything. And there were days probably that if I was of a different in position, I might not have been able to get out of bed. But I've got a family. I've got missus. My missus never let me lie in bed all day, quite frankly. But I still got up at 5:30 in the morning and went to the gym and kept my routine going and just tried to use that as the hour to forget about all the shit that was going on. And then, you know, you come and log on and you get back on the grind, don't you? But it was, there were very, very tough times, particularly when you know you've got to look after your staff and your reputations, everything. And even now, I don't need to mention them, but an esports org in the UK has just gone into, it's gone into administration owing 200,000 pounds worth of unpaid debts to players, for example. I mean, that I couldn't sleep at night if that was me. So I think my moral conscience is something that I've always dealt with quite well. And if I say so myself, it's how I've kept my credibility and integrity across the industry. So this job came on my desk. It was Boxer were looking for a general counsel. And funnily enough, it came via one of my London United investors who is invested in a recruitment company. And he said to his partner, I think I've got a guy that you should see. And it was flagged to me. And I was like, I like boxing. I've been to Hatton Mayweather in Vegas. I grew up in Glasgow when Gary Jacob was relatively successful. I've been to AJ fights. I went to Froth Groves too at Wembley. So I know my boxing. And I know how political it is. I've known a few promoters. I've known the matchroom guys for a long time because I did some work with the PDC after my Formula One days. So look, I know boxing, but this is a very interesting role. So I did a bit of due diligence on it and then met Ben Shalom, the chief exec. And his story is quite remarkable because he got the Sky contract when Eddie and I went off to DAZN a couple of years ago. And you know, I wasn't sold on just having a strict legal role. I felt I was going backwards, but ultimately I needed to earn a living as well. And I needed to get myself back in the hamster wheel. And I thought it would be quite good for showing my versatility again, having been an entrepreneur, to be able to go back into another environment and another sector. So I ultimately took the job on a short-term basis with Ben and ended up being there for a year. I was meant to really transition more into an operational COO role, but just the nature of Ben and how he's operated very successfully, he has his ways of working, and you know, it's not my first rodeo, and he wants something that I don't want to do or can't give, or you know, ultimately I was set on going in a different direction, so we just parted amicably, and I actually told him about my plans, because ultimately I recognized, and this is how we get into Summit Sports, that athletes were particularly in boxing, but ultimately wider, being underserviced. And, you know, promoters often build up an athlete for their show, and then that athlete might not, or that boxer might not fight for the next 6, 8, 9, 10 months. So they almost get forgotten about. So who's looking after them in the interim? Additionally, you know, I saw in boxing a manager, a trainer, an S&C coach, someone with a content PR person sometimes too, and then you know, a lawyer, et cetera, et cetera. So you could end up having an entourage of 10 people. I was like, how is that cost effective? How is that efficient, like, for a boxer to manage? Like, a boxer should be focused on boxing and, you know, profile building to sell tickets, et cetera, and bring brands in, and should have a good team around them. And it needs to be more streamlined, in my view. And
well, it seems like that's the model, Ollie, right? Like, you know, I think I'm not going to bash Matchroom, right? I don't know enough about the business. Obviously, a very successful business. But obviously, their whole success is predicated on getting one or two absolute megastars, right? That's when it becomes cost-effective, when you get the likes of AJ fighting for, what was it, $39 million in Saudi the other day. So I think you're right in that, like, in a similar way to how Ted Brady is going about it at Lake Sports, he's only going to pick, like, I think 5 golfers max. Because he's like, how can you properly service like a sports person and enable them to perform to the highest when you have 15, 20 people on your roster? You have to employ people, you can't maintain the same standards, etc. So it seems like a similar ethos to what you're bringing to Summit.
Yeah, so we decided we wanted to take a different approach and not step people's toes. But if I take a step back, I wanted to build something that was, again, had a USP. London United had a USP. It was all about purpose. So I felt, I've got all this gaming and esports experience. What do I do with it? Well, I'm going to try and bring it into the sports world. In my head, I saw you as a boxer coming into an activation with one of our content creators and a brand paying over the top for that, as opposed to just a brand paying you to do an activation or paying the creator to do an activation. A lot more interesting. I felt cross-pollination could be quite an interesting USP to have. So Therefore, Summit Sports has been founded off the back of sport and creators. Majority are gaming creators, but actually one of my partner's creators is a violinist, funnily enough. But it's all about giving athletes and talent the opportunity for peak exposure, peak earnings, peak performance, all in one place so that they can be taken to the top. And if that means we work exclusively or non-exclusively with them, we're not so bothered. As long as we can help them, or we feel we can help them, they feel we are a good team for them, and you know, there's a lot of trust and integrity and transparency and professionalism that comes with it. But ultimately, if you want to be managed under one, you know, I'm not allowed to say one roof because we're Summit, and under one roof you wouldn't be able to see the Summit. But if you wanted to be managed in one place, we can do everything. But if you just want content, gaming strategy, PR support, commercial support, that's also what we can do. So we built verticals around boxing, motorsport, and creators to start with. We've been exploring football as well in quite a short time frame, given we only launched 2 weeks ago. And it's exciting, you know, built a strong team already. We're being quite aggressive about it. Adam Smith, 30 years at Sky Sports, is director of boxing talent. We brought in a YouTuber, Oakley, to work with my partner, Ben, on the creator side. We're talking to an ex-Formula One world champion about being the advisor on the motorsport vertical. We've got a 14-year-old Joshua signed up to us, who's a karting champion, who is being touted as the next Lewis Hamilton, but he wants to be a sim racing champion. So we're going for established talent and up-and-coming talent across those verticals. But I'm under no illusion the opportunities that present themselves. And already, you know, I'm helping a music artist on behalf of someone. My other co-founder is head of performance. He's also a licensed manager with the BBBOC, but he's brought a music artist to the table to try and help. So it'll be interesting if we were to do this in a couple of years to see where Summit has got to, because I'd be amazed if we were just in those three lanes still.
Amazing. Yeah, no, I hear what you're saying, because a lot of what I see or observe as an outsider is that, like, you know, as a brand, let's use golf as an example. You know, why would you spend your marketing dollars on a golfer who might be good at the game for, or might be in the top 50 in the world for a couple of years, but has no real commercial value, no real online following, when you can go and find a creator who's consistently putting out content on a regular basis with a very defined target audience. Like, everything's in the analytics. You can see the age ranges, the gender, the everything you need to know about a demographic you can see. So why would you put your dollars into a professional athlete if they're not at the very top of the game? So it's interesting that you're cross-pollinating, because what I assume it does is opens up opportunities for professional athletes who aren't at the top of the game, might not ever reach the top of the game, but can still have a very commercially viable living.
Well, absolutely. But I think it also still works for athletes at the top of their game who might not be able to hit the demographic that the creator's hitting. Because you've just said, you know, you go into the insights on Instagram and you can see, you know, the age and location and gender, and your athlete that you've just been talking about might not be hitting two out of three of those categories that, you know, they want to hit. So it broadens their reach, appeal, and their potential earning power as well. But I think it's a good opportunity for the up-and-coming talent to, it's got to be authentic, of course, to be brought into a different environment to build out the profile.
Amazing. And I'm obviously, like, golf's my sort of number one sporting passion. I'm a big Sunderland fan as well. Love my rugby. I'm just an overall big sports fan. Love my UFC, boxing, etc. But I'm really interested. What's your sort of take on the modern golfing landscape? Have you got have you been watching closely? Have you got an opinion on it?
Well, have you been watching the Netflix series?
I've just started the second Full Swing. Yeah.
Full Swing. So the first one was interesting, wasn't it? Because it was all about the live breakup and the players being attracted to it, and now it's, you know, Rory's become the spokesperson for those that didn't quite make the jump and now have been forced to coalesce, is that the right word?
I guess, yeah.
But I think golf's a great sport, isn't it? It's nothing like the Ryder Cup. I mean, who doesn't look forward to the Ryder Cup? And I think if I'm pragmatic with LIV, you look at what they've done in boxing and football. they're spending money to try and, of course, raise awareness. Let's not be disingenuous and call it what it is. It is to raise awareness, but they're doing it in a way that's also going to grow the sport. And I remember a few years ago when the Saudis tried to come into esports with Blast and others, publishers, it was an awful experience. The community revolted. But now look at where they've got to. There's the Esports World Cup's happening there next year. So, you know, the community is seeing that these sports are being invested in and they're trying to do it the right way. And that's my hope for golf, that actually it will raise the profile of not just the top 50 athletes, but, you know, it will help grow the game top to bottom. And, you know, the commercial earning power will increase across the game. But love golf. I do love golf. I think the Ryder Cup is just the most exciting event, you know, every couple of years it takes place. And it's just got this genuine authenticity about it, doesn't it? That it doesn't matter how much a player earns at that point, they're playing for their country and you're backing them. And you'll never lose that.
That's it. That's something I also love about golf. It's just, I think it's like the purest meritocracy, or was anyway, where, you know, you have players who might just hit peak performance for 2 years and then drop off. You look at like Henrik Stenson. Yes, he had an amazing career, but I think he went from being like top 10 in the world to like 350 within the space of 18 months. You have to keep playing well for a long period of time in order to maintain your status, maintain your cards, maintain your playing privileges, and then obviously maintain your commercial power as well. So I just love that like meritocracy element of the sport. And I think in relation to like the Saudi money, I'm not really sure where I stand at the moment. I'm sitting on the fence a little bit because I think innovation is a good thing. I think growing the sport's a good thing. But then there's something about the tradition and storytelling in sport that I don't think the Saudi based investments have quite managed to get right yet, right? You look at the AJ and Ngannou fight, right? Yeah, great, okay? But for me, the atmosphere was terrible. I'd much prefer to watch that at Wembley. Watching that at Wembley with 80,000 fans, sorry to sort of reference Carl Froch there, would be far more entertaining for me and has far more depth and authenticity about the storytelling than knowing he's just in the ring for 40, he's only going there because he's getting 40 million quid, you know? So I feel like there's a disconnect between the financial investment and the innovation of the game. That's probably a good thing. But the authentic storytelling, I think, has been lost. And that's perhaps where what you're doing in cross-pollinating athletes and other creators can maybe play a part. I'm not sure.
Well, we like to think we've brought one of the best storytellers into Summit Sports, Adam Smith. I mean, he built careers of Ricky Hatton, AJ, Prince Naz Hamid. So he knows how to storytell. But you also hit on something just before that, which was career longevity and how long it lasts. Like, what are these athletes thinking about? Once they hit 350 in the world, do they even have the love to keep playing? They probably made enough money to retire, but they're going to be bored, aren't they? So what are they thinking about? Are they thinking about investing? Are they thinking about commentary and media? Are they thinking about coaching? And that's something we want to help the athletes think about. So we actually wanted to say, let's go, let's do a reset. What is it you want to achieve? Where do you want to get to in your current career? Where do you want to get to after? How can we be a part of that and help you along? And it might just be, you know, you want to open up a golf driving range. You've no idea how to do it. Well, we'll help you. Even if we don't have the expertise, we can bring the people in. We've got the network to help you. So you don't need to worry about going out to find them all. You can concentrate on yourself at the moment and what's important, and we'll do the hustling.
Love it, absolutely love it. What are you most excited about over in your first year at Summit? What are some of your goals? Or your what we call BHAGs, big hairy audacious goals? Where would you like to be in a year from now?
Well, I would hope that we've got decent rosters in each of the verticals. I would like to have a footprint in football as well. I think you can't ignore football; it's the biggest sport in the world, isn't it? And also, I've got this great network. I mean, I worked at the Premier League for 7 years. I've got a relationship with European leagues and clubs, so I think it would be remiss of me not to try and utilise that experience. But, you know, where do I want to be in a year? I want to be a credible management agency that is renowned for looking after its talent in the right way and making waves.
I love that you've got, like, integrity at the heart of what you do, because I think, unfortunately, like, when you say the word sports agent, people just think cowboys, don't they? And I think that's maybe just been born from the bad practices that we've seen in football for so long, right? And maybe some of the corruption that we've seen in transfers. You see the same transfer getting made to the same manager three times in the career. You see all sorts of shady stuff going on. And what I like about media being at the forefront of everything that we do now is that I think transparency now has a place in business that I never had before. It was easier to sort of be more shady 20 years ago. Now I feel like the transparency of everything has made us a lot more conscious about how we do business. So I love that integrity and doing the right thing by the player is something that that's close to you. Because what I think a lot of people don't understand, I've got another really good friend who's a footballer at the moment. He, you know, yes, they might get really good contracts and make a lot of money, but you'd be, I can't remember the statistics, so I don't want to talk absolute crap, but I'm pretty sure it's like 30% of Premier League footballers go bust after their careers, right? Because they surround themselves in the wrong circles. They have people asking them for money. They give it out willy-nilly. They have a huge expenditure, very expensive lifestyles. And when they finish, they get bored. And what you do when you're bored, you're a man, you spend it on gambling, drink, drugs. There's a whole, you know, there's a plethora of things you can go and spend your money on. And so I don't think it's been brought to the fore enough just how much athletes were born and trained to be athletes, but they didn't have a clue about the money. All of a sudden, you've got like hundreds of thousands in the bank. You don't have a clue how what to do with it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Have you got an IFA? Are you investing wisely? No, you're absolutely right.
Absolutely. Cool. And what I'd love to understand as well, Ollie, like the world of boxing is a really interesting one for me, just because of what's happening with the YouTuber boxing community, UFC, boxing crossovers. Just being involved in the world of boxing, I guess, intensively for the past sort of 18 months, how do you see boxing progressing? How does boxing improve? How does it remain? How does boxing keep its integrity?
Well, it's a big question, that, actually. I mean, I think the first thing to say is boxing's probably never been healthier in this country. There are more and more promoters. There are more shows than ever. There's a new promoter that's come on the scene, GBM, Izzy Azif. He's trying to do things differently, small hall, big productions, Talk Sport, YouTube deal. Yeah. So I think on the promoter side, it's quite interesting. It's a question on Sky and, you know, what are they going to do with boxing going down the line? I think it's no secret that with the Premier League new deal, there's going to be more football on TV. So what does that mean for Sky's love of boxing, so to speak? Mm-hmm. And I think for the boxers, they've just got to really choose the right direction that they want to go in career, and they've got to trust people around them. But I mean, I'd be saying to a boxer, irrespective of I'm working with them or not, when you're going to sign a deal, what is the promoter going to do for you? What is the strategy around your career, promotionally, digitally? What can they do for you outside of the sport? And I don't think enough do that, if I'm honest. I think on a governance perspective, the old Conor Benn situation has been unfortunate. It's been a very testing time for the board. It's been not ideal for Matchroom and Conor, obviously, either, because he wants to fight in the UK with a British licence. So the sooner that that's all resolved. And then what I do hope is that the board looks at issues that have materialised in the past and thinks about, how can we improve the sport? We want to be the good citizens of the sport. If there's no overarching world body for boxing, is there? There's no FIFA, there's no IOC, for example, or ICC for cricket.
Yeah.
So boxing in this country has got to be looked after by the board. And does it need to refresh its rule book, for example? Does it need to have a look at how it deals with issues that have arisen in the past? You know, that's what I would probably say on the governance side.
Interesting, yeah. I've been a huge follower of the UFC, obviously, since Conor McGregor came on the scene. But I'm not close enough to the game to comment on, like, on fighter pay and looking after fighters behind the scenes. But what I love about the UFC, which any, I think, viewer does, is that the fight always fight the best.
Yes.
The best fighters always fight the best fighters, right? Whereas in boxing, it feels like you're just trying to protect your zero. And the best might never fight the best. How the sport surely got to evolve. I mean, there might be more participation in boxing because of YouTubers and whatnot. But at the top of the game, how is boxing going to ensure that the best fight each other more often?
Well, I like the UFC model because it's all centralized, isn't it? So that works very well. But I think promoters have come out recently and said, we're going to stop giving boxers easy fights. We're going to have to start making better fights. And it's incumbent on the promoter to do that. And if the boxer doesn't like it, then arguably the boxer's in either the wrong place or it's not got a promoter that understands the journey that the boxer needs to go on. There is always an argument why a boxer might need a tune-up. But then do it, you know, you could do it very quickly, you could do it very cheaply. It doesn't need to be on one of those shows. You could go to a small hall show, couldn't you, and just get your tune-up away.
Yeah.
But there needs to be bigger fights. I mean, it's a crying shame that AJ Fury never happened. I think it probably will now, but probably not.
Well, you better storyline now, arguably, right?
Yeah, but probably neither of them wanted to lose their unbeaten streak. Yeah. Makes it more difficult, doesn't it? They got so much money. You just alluded to how much money. And I think you were probably on the lower scale of what I've read online is true, what AJ picked up. But they got so much money now, haven't they, that they don't actually even need to fight. So why are they going to put their record at risk for another big payday that they in reality don't need?
Yeah, it'll be interesting. And then obviously Netflix's entrance into live streaming with a bang, right, this year with Jake Paul fighting Mike Tyson.
As well. Oh dear, don't get me started on that. Although I did see some footage of Mike Tyson hitting the bag or sparring with his coach. I was like, oh geez, Jake Paul might be in trouble.
Did you not like that? Do you not like the whole fight? Or
it's unnecessary. I just think it's unnecessary. Like Mike Tyson, I want to remember him for the good times, you know, when I was staying up at 4 or 5 in the morning to watch Tyson fight Bruno. I don't want to see him fight Jake Paul, who, you know, I don't want it to be disparaging of Jake Paul, but and he may become a good professional boxer, but that's just one of those exhibition fights. I mean, again, like, I don't like the Floyd Mayweather exhibition fights against Aaron Chalmers, for example. I just think it's unnecessary. So I think it's what is more interesting is the fact it's on Netflix and it's not going to be behind an additional paywall. Most people will have Netflix be paying the subscription. It's not then pay-per-view. Yeah. So it'll be interesting to see how it does. I mean, I wouldn't stay up to watch it, but I'd certainly watch it if I was on or if I was, you know, awake, or I'd tune into it the next day. But it wouldn't be one of those that's going to make me stay up during the night to watch it.
No, exactly. Like, this is where I feel like Eddie Hearn hit the nail on the head. He did an interview with Jake Paul and put him in his place so beautifully, which was he echoed pretty much what you said, which is like, you're just not nowhere near the top of the sport. You're a good fighter. What you've done, your progression is incredible. Like, hats off to you. But you're just not an elite fighter. I'm the same. I don't like these exhibition bouts. But at the same time, I am very excited about the fact that Netflix are getting into sports, because like you say, I think people, I don't want to bash Sky either, but probably fed up of paying the prices that someone like Sky maybe charges for a limited amount of coverage. So it'll be interesting to see what these streaming sites do over the next couple of years. Obviously Apple, Amazon, these are all companies as well that have dived headfirst in recently.
Well, Eddie was more eloquent describing Jake's ability than I was, but I'm not here to defend Sky. I think Sky do a bloody brilliant job of promoting boxing because they're able to promote, they're able to cross-pollinate. You watch Premier League game, they can advertise boxing. That's something that other channels don't really have. So I think it's just, you know, the pay-per-view market, there's probably been too many pay-per-views that aren't pay-per-views. You know, you remember real pay-per-views in the past and the buzz that was created about them. And I think that's probably where people have got fed up paying for something they think that should be free but isn't. So actually Taylor Cattrall on DAZN, he made available to customers, is quite an interesting one because that would have been a pay-per-view on Sky whenever we tried to do it. I mean, there's no secret, we were ready to announce Taylor Cattrall when I was at Boxer and then Josh got injured. But that being made available probably goes down very well with the DAZN subscribers. The problem is that the DAZN footprint in the UK isn't really as big as where they've got domestic football rights, like in Italy, for example, where it works really well, DAZN, doesn't it? Because they've got Serie A, so they've got a lot of subscribers off the back of it. But I think they probably would admit as well that the UK market for them is still quite a challenge to penetrate without the Premier League.
Without other stuff, yeah, nice, interesting, cool. One thing I want to sort of finish with, Ollie, is like, what I love about your sort of career is that You've taken risks from quite a traditional, let's say, quote-unquote traditional career path in being a lawyer, right? And you ventured into entrepreneurship. You've had highs and lows. What's your, like, message to any entrepreneurs embarking on their first business or second business or going through some lows about how to keep at it and keep fighting, basically?
I don't know. I think you've got to have a certain character, don't you? I mean, I talk to people that I've worked with in the past, and they're still in their jobs after 15 years, and they say to me, "Oh, we're not risk takers like you, Ollie." But I think it's a character, isn't it? You know, I always like the autonomy. I want to be the master of my destiny. I want to create something and benefit from it. And don't get me wrong, if the dream job had come along at various junctures after leaving, whether it was Formula One or even after London United or more boxer, let's say, I may have gone down that path. But I have got this itch where I want to be part of something, create something and make a difference. And the lows are a challenge. There's no glossing over them. And I think everyone deals with them in different ways. I'm not going to say, you know, go and sit in a dark room and meditate for an hour, because that certainly isn't what I did. I know this, but this might not even be the correct way to say it. I put on my big boy pants and just got on with it. And I realized I had a family, I needed to provide for them, and, you know, had to try and leave work outside the kitchen door at mealtimes, for example, and then go back to it and just fight and fight and fight to the extent that it was in my destiny. And, you know, the biggest challenge as an entrepreneur is when you need money and fundraising, I think. And fundraising, there's no glossing over it. It's awful. From start to finish, it's just an awful process. It's time consuming. People make you promises. They don't deliver. They haggle you on valuation. They try and squeeze you for a bit of extra here or there. You do a deal, the money doesn't come in immediately. It can send you, you know, it's give you all sorts of problems. So fundraising is the one bit of advice I probably give someone going into business now is saddle yourself with someone who knows how to raise properly. And that means from doing the right deck, the right forecast model, who to approach. If I'd had that experience person from the start, I was very naive. I thought, proof of concept, you're going to raise money. London United, I genuinely thought, we've done this first event, it's amazing, we'll go out and raise money. I never had appreciated how time-consuming it was. And even now with Summit, it's the same. It just, it's very character-building, let's say.
I just love that. And I like your quote-unquote, like, old-school type mentality of, like, putting your big boy pants on. I don't think, like, I think that gets, like, demonized in today's world. I think masculinity in itself gets viewed as toxic, every part of it. But what you say about providing for your family, about getting on with it and persistence is a really strong message. And you said something earlier, which I'm going to take away, is you still got up every day at 5:30, you still went to the gym. And I think when you're consistent in the face of adversity, you build self-esteem. And over a long enough period of time, that pays off. So a testament to you. And thank you so much for taking the time to come on, Ollie. You didn't need to do this. For everyone who's listening, I sent Ollie a WhatsApp voice note, and he kindly responded. So thank you very much for taking the time.
No, I've enjoyed it. Thanks for having me on.
Good. Cheers, Ollie. Thanks so much.